Welcome to What in the World. My name is Andre. I'm being joined by Ryan. And there's a lot that's happening that you might not have really seen in the news. First of all, there's a situation involving this Pegasus project. France has just ordered an investigation into Pegasus. Apparently, there have been the numbers of 3 presidents, 10 prime ministers, and the King of Morocco in the over 50,000 phone records that have been uncovered as part of the reporting on Pegasus, on the Pegasus project. This is according to the Washington Post. Ryan, can you tell us a bit more about what this Pegasus project is?
Yeah, this is a deeply kind of concerning a story that's now coming to light. And so it starts off, you know, the story starts off in Israel, where this NSO group, which is an Israeli cybersecurity company, has developed this spyware called Pegasus. And what it does is it goes into, you know, phones. They're able to access phones. And the company says that it is used as a way for governments to surveil those who are subjected to either terrorist or serious crimes charges, as well as some other things. And so they are claiming that their services are not allowed to be used for just, you know, surveilling anyone, normal people, but under, you know, these particular licenses. And they say that, you know, governments know that there's this restriction. Of course, there's no real way to enforce it unless they find it and then, you know, cease the government's access to the spyware. But anyway, Andre, as you said, you know, you have it's been found that, you know, there's spyware on the phones of activists, journalists, and business people confirmed. And then there's this list of some 50,000 people, including very high-level individuals who are presumably being spied on by governments around the world. Interestingly, it's been reported that the Moroccan government was the government spying on French President Emmanuel Macron, as well as other French officials. They, of course, are denying it. And so this really kind of, you know, brings to light some of the major issues that kind of erupted in the post-Snowden era of government surveillance.
Yeah, I mean, like the president of South Africa and the Pakistani prime minister, Imran Khan, apparently their numbers have been revealed in this. Apparently the Dalai Lama's inner circle, their numbers have been revealed in this. It's quite a wide-ranging group of people. I mean, it's a king out of all the people. A former president of Mexico, Felipe Calderon, and then Robert Malley, who is a former American diplomat, was the chief negotiator for the JCPOA.
I believe he's back in government in the Biden administration in an NSC role in the Middle East, right?
Yeah, this is crazy. Wow. So who developed Pegasus?
Yeah. So this cybersecurity firm in Israel called the NSO Group, they're a prominent cybersecurity firm in, you know, Israel, of course, has many security contractors that work around the world that develop many products for governments. This is just one of them. And interestingly, NSO Group was reportedly the company that hacked into Jeff Bezos' phone in 2018, which I found to be, you know, rather, you know, ironic. But you know, I don't know much about NSO other than, you know, they provide a variety of services for their clients. Many of their clients include governments and security services in a variety of countries, especially those that are not, you know, the friendliest. And so, of course, you know, as a private company, they can sell their services to whomever they so choose. And, you know, it's a very lucrative business to provide surveillance software to governments.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it does certainly harken back to those Edward Snowden revelations, and then the discovery that we were, like, you know, wiretapping Angela Merkel's phone. I saw this interview with George W. Bush recently, where he was being interviewed by DW, the German news outlet, on the occasion of Angela Merkel's departure from the chancellorship. Again, you know, was referred often as the leader of the free world. Been German chancellor for 16 years, parliamentary system, so she's really had a lot of power there. But they asked him if he knew about the wiretapping of Angela Merkel, and he was like, oh, I didn't know it. I didn't know about that. who knows whether he did or not know about that. But Ryan, you, I want to move on to another story, maybe a story that's a bit deviating from our usual. But you mentioned Jeff Bezos, now the second billionaire to go into space with, what was it called? Blue Moon?
Blue Origin.
Blue Origin. Not Blue Moon.
The beer?
Blue Origin. He follows Richard Branson, everyone's favorite long-haired billionaire, into space. I wanted to bring this up because I think the whole idea, there have been a lot of critiques of these billionaires going into space, right? They're like, oh, why don't we use the money for solving world hunger or whatever. I think space travel is fairly important, to be honest, because perhaps it'll improve infrastructure on, you know, the world in on Earth, but it's also like the next foray, and the fact that the private sector can do this stuff, I think is very interesting, right? It opens up a realm of possibilities, a realm of innovation, especially Branson's thing. He landed that little plane there, but we had an episode with Frank Rose way back in October that sort of talks about space. And one question I have is, you know, when we're sending now private enterprise into space, what does that mean for who controls space? Right? I mean, I don't know if you all have seen Space Force starring Steve Carell, but I think one of the big things was that the US and China and Russia were all engaged in sort of taking over space. Who, like, How is that going to look 20 years, 30 years, 40 years in the future as we start to put ourselves more and more up there in terms of a national sort of sense? It's a very curious question I've had.
I think the interesting aspect of this is that in the United States, at least, it's a commercial space race where you have these private companies competing for, you know, supremacy in space travel, in, you know, mining or developing colonies. All that, you know, sort of developments. But in other countries, particularly, you know, our adversaries like Russia and China, you have the governments that are leading their space races. And so, you know, NASA, of course, is engaged in a variety of activities with the Space Force. Andre, as you mentioned there, you know, will be more activity in space and in conducting space operations. It seems like the United States is more focused on the private sector side. And so it'll be fascinating to see just, you know, how the public-private partnership actually comes together in order to kind of compete for the future of space.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting. I mean, I do sort of agree, and I hope that what Richard Branson says is true, that, you know, this is a step in making space travel more accessible for the layman like us who could never afford $200,000 to $250,000 per pop on his Virgin Galactic seat. I did enter that competition, though, on Omaze, where I could win a seat on Richard Branson's flight in 2022. Take the burn back to space, man. Like, let's do it. But Ryan, there's been some, speaking of that, not speaking about that at all, but the Cuba situation is still ongoing. We talked a bit about it last week, all the protests that have been basically clamoring against the government's incompetence and ineptitude in providing a lot of basic services with the economic downturn, because, as we know, Cuba's tourism industry has taken a hit. And then the pandemic has really sort of done a lot of damage to Cuba's economy. And, of course, the Cuban government is an authoritarian, repressive regime, as we all should know. There's been some Florida politicians, though, who have advocated for President Biden to send in Wi-Fi balloons over Cuba, because the Cuban government, I believe, has sort of clamped down on internet access there. What could go wrong?
Yeah, what could go wrong? Sending in balloons? You know, I haven't been a child in a long time, but every time I sent a balloon up in the air, it typically popped. And it also could be shot down by the Cuban government, who would likely not enjoy balloons by the United States being flown into their airspace. It's just that it's a ridiculous, I mean, while, you know, noble in providing the Cuban people access to, you know, social media, the internet, et cetera, it's not a good idea. It's, I mean, I can't even imagine that working well at all.
Yeah, I don't really think it's I don't really see how it's going to work, especially since the Cuban military has guns and other weapons that can shoot things down. Also, China and Russia are very much on Cuba's side. So I'm not really sure how that would work, but I mean, hey.
Hey, ideas are ideas, and everyone has an idea. Some are better than others. But I will say the administration is sanctioning Cuban officials for their repression of the Cuban people. That at least is a substantive step that has impacts on their officials' ability to navigate the international financial system, which everyone depends upon, as well as, you know, any sort of investment that they would like to make around the world. And so that at least has an impact, but, you know, sending balloons, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Anyway, Ryan, there's some interesting stuff happening in Belarus. Can you tell us more? Belarus.
Yeah, so Belarus. Interestingly, so of course, I think maybe our listeners are familiar now with, you know, President Lukashenko and opposition leader Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya. There were elections in Belarus that were not free nor fair. And the incumbent president, Alexander Lukashenko, ended up winning. Mass protests around the country. The security services met those protests with huge force. People had been killed and jailed. So there's no, you know, no press freedom in the country, no freedom of assembly. And so the opposition leader, Ms. Tsikhanouskaya, has been living in exile in Lithuania. She's been traveling around the world, most notably to Western countries, where she has been trying to, you know, get support for her cause, for the Belarusian people, in order to have some sort of solution whereby the dictator, Alexander Lukashenko, is removed from power. Of course, Belarus is very closely tied to Russia, but she came to the United States with many of her now exiled officials and were met with a variety of U.S. officials, including National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and Secretary of State Antony Blinken. They had very substantive meetings from what it's reported. She has advocated for stronger action by the United States. So there have been sanctions levied by many European countries. And I mean, it's a very difficult situation because, you know, you're not going to really have any success in removing Lukashenko by force by Western powers. Russia's not going to allow that. That's just going to lead to a war that no one wants. But what you can do is put pressure on the country's financial system. And that, you know, has pressure from below, where the Belarusian people can rise up and there might be some change. It really is, you know, if you create a situation whereby President Vladimir Putin of Russia no longer sees Lukashenko as someone who can maintain power, if he moves out of the picture, then it's far easier for a democratic Belarus to emerge.
For sure. And Ryan, I mean, in terms of the formalities of power that Lukashenko has, constitutionally, do they have elections? How often are these elections? Is he rigging the vote? What's going on?
Yeah, so I mean, it is a modern day autocracy. There are elections. I mean, he was ostensibly elected in a you know, quote unquote democratic election in the 90s, but over time, they become increasingly less democratic, less free, less fair, and so. I mean, he's been ruling the country for decades, and his family has a lot of financial interests that are, you know, very corrupt in the country. His family members are also involved in the political system. And so it's, again, it's not a free nor fair country. There aren't democratic elections. Anyone who's been observing them, these, you know, independent election observers, of which they, you know, operate very difficultly in the country, they have said that they're not free or fair. The people of Belarus, you know, don't want Lukashenko as their leader, and anyone who gets, you know, a 90 some percent, you know, election win, I mean, that's just, come on, I mean, unreasonable. At least, you know, other autocrats have a far less high numbers in winning, and that at least seems a bit more reasonable. But of course, Lukashenko, it's a vanity project, and he just wants to maintain power. So civil society in Belarus is, you know, it's very difficult. They don't have, you know, a lot of funding, nor the ability to operate openly. But there are many, you know, civil society organizations and media organizations that have been operating to kind of get their voices heard. I think we talked about the story on What in the World maybe a month ago, 2 months ago, about that. He might have, he's probably no, not much older than us, but this media personality and blogger was basically arrested because they, the Belarusian government said there was a, you know, made a fake bomb threat that downed a, you know, that had forced a plane to land in Belarus, in Minsk, so that they could arrest this guy and his girlfriend. And so, I mean, the regime is taking all the steps they can to maintain the power structure that they have. But if the international community comes together, you know, they can strip it away. It's possible.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, the situation in Belarus sounds like a disaster. But you know what else is a disaster? The Tokyo Olympics. That's a disaster. That's a $20 billion disaster. Obviously, the people in Tokyo are not happy about the fact that the government was putting in lockdowns in preparation for the Olympics and that COVID's been spiking there. And now a lot of these Olympians are getting COVID themselves. There's no audience. Typically, when you get the Olympics, you build stuff so all your businesses can thrive because everyone flies in, right? Well, in Tokyo, that's not going to happen. And now all these people are getting COVID. $20 billion disaster.
It is terrible. As much as, you know, I think I and many people around the world enjoy watching the Olympics, I mean, this just is a cluster.
Yeah. And I mean, talking about clusters, COVID-19, the Delta variant is really spreading all throughout, I mean, the world at this point. As we remember, the Delta variant started off in India. Really ravaged that country, especially before the vaccine, especially because it ravaged the country before the vaccines were readily available in India. I think now it's really spreading like wildfire in the UK. It's spreading here quite a bit too, but it's spreading especially amongst the unvaccinated, That's why a state like Mississippi, for example, is getting hit quite hard by this, is because many of the folks in Mississippi refuse to get the vaccines. And we're sort of starting to see a big push by a GOP leadership for, you know, basically their constituents to get the vaccine.
Yeah, it is. It is incumbent upon our leaders to advocate for, you know, improving the public health of, you know, their constituents. And so everyone should go get vaccinated. You know, of course, you have, you know, the strain, the, all these different strains. And so hopefully that we can manage this Delta variant and all the other variants that may emerge. Because I think everyone just wants to return to some sort of normalcy. And so,
yeah,
go get vaccinated.
Well, you know who's someone who's not going to return to some normalcy? Tom Barrack, who was a former supporter and advisor to former President Trump. He was arrested because there are allegations that he was basically working as a foreign agent for the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, the Gulf country with the great airlines, Emirates and Etihad. But yeah, basically, like, there's been allegations by the FBI. There's this federal indictment that's occurring right now. Apparently, he used his ties to Trump administration officials, the Trump campaign, to basically help the UAE. For example, according to Politico, he had inserted some pro-UAE language into Trump campaign speeches in 2016. He worked very closely with UAE officials in terms of coordinating how he appeared in media, different publications he had done, and that he basically had wanted to sort of attain this position, a U.S. diplomatic position in the Middle East. The guy's like pretty rich too. He's like worth $1 billion, but money does not solve stupidity.
And you're also not above the law in the United States. And so, you know, this is a very serious offense. It's under 18 USC 951, I believe. And it's basically, you know, charges you as acting as foreign agent of another government. It's what the U.S. government charged Maria Butina, who was, you know, acting as a foreign agent of Russia when she was basically spying on some, you know, I believe they were, you know, related to the NRA or Republican, you know, money raisers. And so, this carries a big prison sentence and is very serious, and the DOJ takes foreign agent offenses very seriously. And so I imagine that there'll be some sort of deal, but, you know, jail time is very real for Mr. Barrack.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, is there any Trump connection here? I think it's just more of an isolated situation with him using the connection to the Trump administration on his own accord.
Yeah, well, this is always the challenge when you have individuals who are, you know, raising money for a political candidate. And, you know, sometimes they're doing it because they believe in the candidate. Other times they do it because they want to use influence to change policy. And if you're doing that in the United States on behalf of, you know, yourself, that's not a federal crime in some scenarios. There are, of course, scenarios where that violates federal election law. But when you're doing it on behalf of a foreign government and you're not reporting that to the Department of Justice, you're being a foreign agent on behalf of another government, and that's illegal. And so that seems to be, under the allegations, what Mr. Barrick and some of his associates have been doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, before we close, I think I wanted to point something out. We are seeing significant flooding in China, significant flooding, right, in the Nordic countries as well. We're seeing the West Coast basically be on fire. These record temperatures every year. I feel like this month is the, hopefully, the month. Well, I mean, it's a year, really. And all the past years are the years that people are finally realizing that climate change is a big problem. We're seeing extreme weather virtually everywhere. I mean, I'm in San Diego. It's pretty nice here. But everywhere else, extreme weather all over the place. Fires, floods. It's crazy.
I mean, it's deeply unfortunate. Just to kind of give a bit more information about the flooding. So in Western Europe and in Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands in particular, there was crazy flooding. If you're interested, I implore you to look at some of the images. It really is just astonishing to see the extent of the flooding. And so in Germany in particular, over 200 people have died. Hundreds are missing. And again, Andre, right, this is a global issue. In China, over 250,000 people have been displaced. Over 33 have been killed in floods there. There are floods in Turkey. And so climate change is not just, you know, some hoax to, you know, try to hurt the U.S. economy. It has real impacts around the world, from floods to, you know, wildfires to, you know, all the other things that, you know, we talk about, the extreme weather changes. And so you know, the Biden administration has been saying that they're going to take many, you know, steps to make meaningful contributions to decreasing our carbon footprint and et cetera. And I know that John Kerry was at a G20 meeting to talk about climate very recently. And so we'll see what the administration actually comes up with. But this has to be addressed. I mean, it's going to have, you know, real impacts in our lifetime.
Yeah, the real problem with a lot of climate change policy is that for so many people who are working in these towns that are centered around coal mines or centered around oil and petrol, is that, I mean, with these coal towns, right, like these people grow up with this industry, they work in the industry is their life, right? So when you tell them that you're going to shut down those coal plants, you know, for sustainable solutions, what does it mean for those people, right? So I feel like, at least underground, right? Like a lot of people don't think that promoting green energies is going to kill their livelihood, kill their own personal family economies. And I feel like the government has to do a much better job of communicating how that may not be the case, why it may not be the case, and actually put in place policies that'll help those people who might see their industries get killed by green energy. Because we need to transition. We need to transition. We can't keep using coal because we're going to see significantly more terrible climate disasters. But you have to figure out, how do you get these people to work, you know, in these industries? Like, I mean, if you're saying we're going to shut down this coal plant in West Virginia so we can create the solar wind farms or whatever in California, how does it help those West Virginians?
I mean, these are the important questions of today. And, you know, any sort of innovation or technological advancement has implications. And of course, negative implications for those whose jobs or livelihoods may not fit within the economic future. But it, you know, it's dependent upon corporations and the governments of countries around the world to work together to find solutions so that these individuals don't fall between the cracks and are kind of left with no careers or livelihoods.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, anyway, Ryan, I think we can wrap up now, basically. Our one-year anniversary for this program is coming up on Monday. I believe that should be the 26th or something. It'll be the 26th. One whole year doing this podcast. We'll be doing a very special episode, no guest on Monday, but a very special episode sort of looking back at the past year, looking at some of our highlights, some of our great guests, some of the great topics and episodes that we've been able to cover. And then also we'll be announcing a significant amount of changes that we will be taking forward into the second year of the program. Changes that, you know, will involve you seeing and hearing a bit more from Ryan and myself during our normal Monday episodes, a bit of new activities that we'll be doing. And we also just launched a new website, so check that out at burnbagpod.com. Ryan, anything else to add?
No, that was perfect. Just a lot of exciting things that will be coming in the next few weeks. And of course, you know, as we go into the second year of the podcast. So as always, thank you all for listening. We really appreciate it. And, you know, please feel free to reach out to us, give us your feedback, whether, you know, you like the podcast, dislike the podcast, any, you know, potential guests that you suggest, or maybe topics for What in the World. We'd love to hear from you. And also, you know, follow us on social media at BurnBagPod. We're always looking to increase our social media footprints. But as always, we'll see you next week.
Sure. See you, folks. Bye.